Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace. So today we're adding another page to the website. This one is going to be book recommendations, not the books that you've probably all seen and all want, but niche books. So you can see I've used a default template and now I'm going to edit that overall header. I'm going to call it recommended books, let people write in for suggestions and I might include those as well. Change this background to something a bit more naval history themed. I'll select this one. This is from my stuff I've already uploaded. And then I'm going to add just a fraction of blur around the text, just so it's a little clearer, just a tiny bit. Get rid of that button. And now I'm going to go into the lower section. This is why I selected the template in the first place, because it has this kind of pre-built layout that I quite like. So I'm going to stick my book in as a test case. Then I'm going to adjust the picture size so it's more book shaped and put in the basic summary. Well, it's a book, but of HMS Belfast by me. I can change the description as well. Just a very quick one. I was going to use this button as a link to Amazon or USNI, but because people shop all over the world, I'm just going to switch that button off, which you can do in this format. And then I could come back and add more books later. Easy. So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenefell. You can get a free trial. And once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show. Something that gets mentioned quite a bit in the reflection, specifically around late 19th and early 20th century naval history, is infrastructure limitations and industrial limitations that hamstrung either the total output or the size of ships that could be built for various navies. This comes up quite a bit with regards to the Marine Nationale, the French Navy, basically any time from the 1890s through to the end of the time period the channel covers. But it can also flare up in certain circumstances, such as when you're looking at the design series that would eventually lead to the G3 battlecruisers and the N3 battleship designs in the UK in the early 1920s. So today, I thought I'd bring together some of the various answers I've given in various dry docks and elaborate a little bit more to give you a slightly better idea of what some of the restrictions on building a gigantic fleet of gigantic doom ships might actually be, especially in the industrial period of the, let's say, roughly 1850s to 1950s that the channel primarily covers. So, in no particular order, we're going to look at seven broad categorizations of infrastructure or infrastructure-associated issues that could affect how many and how large a fleet you can actually build. Shipyard size is the first one we're going to look at. Now, this might seem a little bit obvious. Obviously, if the shipyard you have can only build up to a certain size of ship, that is as big as you can build. Or is it? In extremis, it is actually possible, certainly by the early 20th century, to build the bulk of a ship's hull on a slipway, even if that slipway is actually too short for the entire ship, launch the hull, and then attach the bow and the stern afterwards. This is actually what was done with the French Richelieu. But outside of such unique situations, you are generally going to be limited in the size of ships you can build by the size of shipyards that you actually have. But this is a little bit more involved than just we have an 800-foot slipway, therefore we can build ships up to 800 feet long. Because slipways are not enough, or graving docks if you want to float a ship out rather than launch it. Because the simple fact of the matter is that eventually that ship is going to need maintenance, and if it's going to go into battle, it's probably also going to need at some point some repairs. So you need somewhere to build a ship of that size, but you also need somewhere that can dry dock a ship of that size. Because there's no point in building a ship of any particularly large size or scale if the first time it suffers a major mechanical breakdown or it needs an overhaul, you physically have nowhere to put it. And expanding shipyards to accommodate new designs can actually be quite tricky. Now, if you're lucky, you might find somewhere that you can build a brand new slipway, but I say that's lucky, and you might be thinking, hang on a minute, but surely you're setting up everything from scratch then. Surely that's going to cost a lot of money compared to just sticking another 50 feet on an existing slipway. Well, you'd think that, but bear in mind that a lot of things will have been built up around that slipway. For example, the tracks on which your cranes are running, or a road or railway along which supplies and materials are being run, or buildings in which those materials are being stored, and so on and so forth. And so extending a slipway or a dry dock might involve having to demolish a good chunk of other infrastructure and replace or relocate it elsewhere, or take the loss, perhaps rerouting things in the case of railways and roads. And after all the time and money that you've spent with all the disruption that that entails, then you can get on with spending the money to actually extend the slipway itself, or the dry dock. Another problem with slipways, and to a certain extent dry docks, is that very often older slipways and dry docks might have been built in a river or an estuary or even in a naturally occurring harbour, and that could handle ships that use those facilities. However, by expanding those facilities and thus being able to take or launch bigger ships, you may end up with geographical constraints. For example, if you have a 600-foot slipway and you expand that to a 900-foot slipway, well, the ship that you can build on a 900-foot slipway is going to go considerably further into the water under momentum when you launch it than your 600-foot ship, all else being the same. And if you happen to be in a shipyard that's based on a river, well, the riverbank on the other side might be a little bit too close for comfort. And that's why, for example, when you see pictures of HMS Hood under construction, you can actually see that her slipway is very specifically aligned with a tributary river to give a little bit of extra running space for when the hull is launched. Just because they could have a slipway that was large enough to build an Admiral-class battlecruiser, albeit only just, at that shipyard, didn't mean that every slipway at that shipyard could be upgraded to do so, because almost every other slipway would involve running into the opposite riverbank. And likewise with dry docks, there may be turning radii or areas of shallow water to consider. But let's say that you've managed to construct, or you already had to hand, large enough slipways and dry docks to facilitate the construction of a large vessel. Great, fantastic. How many of those do you have, and where are they? You see, this is another issue that's going to affect how big a ship you can build. Because even if you are a nation which is planning primarily to base your fleet around your home waters, building one ship is usually not that useful. You tend to want to build a class. But a class means multiple ships, and that means both multiple hulls on the stocks at any one time, in theory at least, and potentially multiple hulls that are going to need maintenance at any one time. And this means that just having one slipway and one dry dock is not going to be good enough, because if you have to build a hull, launch it, then start building the next hull and launch that, and so on and so forth, based on typical build times, you could be there for anything from 8 to 12 years before the last hull hits the water. And then it's got to go through fit out and commissioning. And, well, in the late 19th and early 20th century, somewhere around a decade to a decade and a half between the first keel plates being laid and the last ship commissioning in a class of four is going to leave that last ship, at minimum, a generation or two behind, and at worst, potentially obsolete. Not to mention the fact that if you then put that class into battle, and let's say two or three of them get damaged, and you only have the one dry dock capable of repairing them, then, again, at minimum, you're going to end up with a good chunk of your best ships out of action for an extended period of time while they're waiting in a queue. And at maximum, or at worst, you could end up with ships either foundering or just their problems getting worse as they sit at a dockside waiting for a dry dock to become available. And another flavour of course, at worst, being that if your enemy has more shipyards and dry docks that are of a size that can handle their biggest ships, they might get their ships repaired and back in commission before you've got most of your ships repaired and back into commission. So when they show up for round two, you're at a significant disadvantage. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to have at least one slipway and at least one dry dock for every ship in a class that you build, although it would be nice. You can get away with a little bit less in Extremis, perhaps half as many, especially when you're talking about dry docks. But that ties into the other thing we were talking about, which is location. Where are these dry docks? Where are these slipways? If you are a nation wherein the Navy is mostly based in home waters, you're actually in a bit of luck because, of course, if you have, say, a class of four, but you only have two dry docks capable of handling the ships, in most circumstances, that's probably going to be okay, at least for the short term. You can maybe pay for some upgrades to other dry docks 5-10 years down the line. However, if you are a Navy that plans to go global, if you're, say, in Europe as a home nation, and your ship is potentially going to be damaging the South Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, or the Pacific Ocean, most damaged ships are, at minimum, not going to want to go all the way to the other side of the planet for repairs. That's going to cost an awful lot of time and money and opportunity, because while your damaged ship is slowly trundling its way halfway around the planet, getting repaired and then coming all the way back, you're down a ship. The enemy, therefore, has an advantage, whereas if you have a dry dock much closer, you can get repaired a lot quicker. And again, worst case scenario, the ship might be damaged in such a manner that it can limp home a few hundred miles to a nearby dry dock for repairs. It may not actually be in a fit state to survive several thousand miles to the other side of the planet, your home dry docks. So even if you have two or three dry docks for a hypothetical four-ship class back at home, if you're fighting anywhere on the planet, you need to have more dry docks of that size and all their associated cranes and so forth in various places around the world so that those ships can be, in times of battle, repaired and in more general times maintained without having to keep coming back to your home ports again. And it was this factor that actually dictated a lot of the downscaling of the various designs that would eventually lead to the G3 and the N3 class for the British. It wasn't that some of the earlier designs like L3 and M3 couldn't be built in the UK. One or two were pushing it a little bit, but most of them could both be built in the UK and could be maintained in the UK, albeit with a very limited number of shipbuilding and ship maintenance facilities. The bigger problem was places like Gibraltar and Malta and latterly Singapore, overseas areas where these ships would be expected to operate, and they didn't have dry docks of sufficient size. And so the options were either upgrade all of those dry docks at great expense, if it was even physically possible to do, or downscale the ship such that they could fit in the existing dry docks, or they could fit in existing dry docks with a limited scope for upgradability. And that's why if you ever find yourself in Gibraltar and you're looking down at the southern end of the harbour, you'll notice a series of dry docks, and the biggest of those dry docks was one of the major considerations when it came to designing the G3s and the N3s, because, well, as you can see, it doesn't have a huge scope for expansion, and it could fit an Admiral-class battlecruiser, but it couldn't fit some of the more ambitious designs that were being drawn up to succeed them. Of course, one way you can get around this is a floating dry dock that you can then take out to wherever it is you want it to be, but that's another line of expense and expertise which you would have to justify. Then you come on to the issue of skilled workers or skilled labour, and that can be another limiting factor. Because, one, if you only have a certain pool of skilled workers, they can only build so many ships at maximum rate. If you want to build more ships, then either you're going to divest your skilled workforce across multiple slipways, which is going to slow down construction of each individual ship, or you're going to be limited in the number of ships you can build, or you're going to have to leaven your work crews with relatively unskilled, recently recruited workers, which could lead to problems, or you might have to train up a whole bunch of additional skilled workers, which will take time and money. And of course, if you're planning on maintaining that rate of construction, fantastic. If you're not, you might have trouble attracting workers if they know that there's going to be work for 2 or 3 years and then there's not going to be work anymore. And even if you have a relatively skilled workforce, if you're trying to build something that's relatively novel for you, they may not have the expertise to do it exactly what it is you want. So for this example, we can look at Germany in the 1930s. Although their shipbuilding industry had taken massive hits due to the Versailles Treaty and the various things that had gone on in the interwar period, at the end of the day, they still had a core of relatively skilled shipyard workers who were capable of building what you might term relatively standard type surface ships, cruisers, battleships, destroyers, that kind of thing. The designs, in some cases, may have been hilariously inefficient or top-heavy, but the workers weren't in charge of that. You gave them the drawings, they would build you what you had designed. If you couldn't design a ship for Toffee, that was your problem. But when it came to building the Graf Zeppelin and her sister ship, Germany had never built an aircraft carrier before. And some of the delays to Graf Zeppelin's construction were simply due to the fact that the workers, having no idea how to build aircraft carriers, and the construction of aircraft carriers was somewhat different from more gun-based surface warships, struggled. There were delays, there were overruns, there were bits that needed to be redone. And although, obviously, they are learning as they are going, and thus if they'd decided to continue the carrier program and build Flugzeug Trager C or D, they almost certainly would have been completed faster without World War II taking place. The Graf Zeppelin and Flugzeug Trager B suffered significant delays simply because the workers didn't really understand what it was that they were doing when it came to building them. And in terms of numbers of skilled workers, this is one of the reasons why HMS Vanguard, despite being laid down theoretically at a point where she should have been completed for the latter stages of World War II, wasn't even launched until after World War II. Now, some of that was deliberate pauses, but a good chunk of those pauses came about simply because there just weren't enough skilled capital ship builders in the UK at the time, once you factored in all the other big capital ships they were building, which included aircraft carriers, and all the big capital ships they were repairing, and all the other stuff that they had to be building and repairing. So at one point, for example, the Implacable, which was an aircraft carrier, and Vanguard were being constructed in the same overall shipyard complex. But there weren't enough skilled capital ship workers in the workforce to work on both full time. And so a decision had to be made. We're going to have to pause one of these in order to get the other one out in something like good time. Otherwise, they're both going to be horribly late. And it was decided at the end of the day that they'd rather have Implacable than Vanguard quickly. And thus, the carrier got built first. And then the work crews could go back to building Vanguard, which, of course, in the interim, hadn't had much happen to her. We'll now briefly touch on gun manufacturing. Of course, if you have a ship that's, say, armed with 12-inch guns and you want it to then be armed with 13.5 or 14-inch guns, your gun-building industry has to be capable of actually building said guns, or potentially you buy them in from overseas. But assuming you want to keep everything in-house, that means potentially all sorts of fun upgrades going on at your gun foundries, which, to be fair, I have covered in separate videos on how to make naval guns, so I won't go into extreme detail here, but suffice to say that extending the gun pits and increasing the size of the lathes and so forth, and the forges for that matter, to make significantly larger naval artillery requires a fair bit of investment and time. And if you're not prepared to make that investment and time, then you aren't going to get bigger guns, which means you're going to face a decision. Best case, the existing guns that you have will still work, at least at something like closer ranges, and you can just try and go for more of them. Worst case, you end up in a situation where the enemy is building their ships to counter their newer, bigger guns, and thus it doesn't really matter how many of your smaller guns you stick on a ship. At most battle ranges, the enemy ships are going to be immune to them, or potentially somewhere in between. An example of this would be the French Normandie and Lyon classes, because if you look at their development histories from a purely objective perspective, somewhat with the Normandies and absolutely definitely with the Lyons, the French wanted to be able to match the increase in gun caliber that they were seeing in various other navies. But while French gun manufacturers could, in theory, upgrade their facilities to be able to construct 15-inch guns, for our sake of argument, the simple fact was that was going to cost a lot of time and money, and the French government didn't want to pay that money or invest that amount of time in doing so, and thus they decided the simpler, faster, and cheaper approach would just be to invent the 13.4-inch quad turret, initially for the Normandies, and then for the Lyons, just add another one of those on. Even though, honestly, the Marine Nationale was quite well aware that by the time of the Lyons design, they could be well behind the curve in terms of not just penetration power, but also protection levels. But they didn't have much of a choice because, well, ultimately the government was in charge of the purse strings, and the government either didn't want to or couldn't pay for the upgrades to gun manufacturers. Then we move on to your overall industrial capacity. Now, thus far, we've spoken about the maximum size of a battleship, a battlecruiser, an aircraft carrier, the skilled workforce required for those kinds of ships. Can you build the biggest possible guns and that kind of thing? But just your general overall industrial base actually makes a huge difference, because there are all sorts of things like, say, geared turbine sets that need to be mass manufactured if you're trying to mass manufacture a navy. If you want lots of cruisers, destroyers, and various flavors of escorts, they all need propulsion. And it's actually a fairly skilled industry that manufactures geared turbines, and specifically the gearing sets for them. So if you want to build hundreds upon hundreds of destroyers and you want them to be nice and fast, you either have to have a huge industry base that can support that, or you accept that you can't build that, or you take creative third-hand solutions, which would be things like equipping them with diesels or turbo-electric drive, or in the case of smaller escorts, perhaps even vertical triple expansion engines. And even the United States of America, which in World War II is sometimes in pop history seen as a bottomless pit of manufacturing capability, was running up against these kinds of bottlenecks. Hence the rather weird and wonderful sets of propulsion units that you could find in various destroyer escort classes, among other things. And at an even more basic level, again, actually using the United States in World War II as an example, because of their sheer size, even the manufacture of steel, particularly in the quantities and of the quality needed for ship construction, can be a bottleneck. If you want to build, let's say, 500,000 tons of shipping, a good chunk of that is going to be made out of steel of various compositions. And if your industry can't supply you with 500,000 tons of steel for your shipbuilding in the requisite types, in the requisite amount of time, bearing in mind that if you are building a massive navy, you probably are also expanding things like tank manufacture and aircraft manufacture, and you have to maintain domestic supplies of various other goods as well. So it's not like you can devote the entire nation's steel output to shipbuilding. Then you're going to run into bottlenecks, and therefore you're not going to be able to build all the ships you want when you want to. This was one of the reasons why the Alaska-class battlecruisers were delayed, because they had to choose where are we going to send our limited amounts of STS steel, and they decided it was better off in carriers and escorts for carriers, at least in the bottleneck years. Now, again, you can overcome this to a certain extent by buying in from overseas. The UK, for example, while it was desperately trying to rebuild its armour manufacturing capabilities in the 1930s, ended up buying in quite a lot of armour-grade steel, at least of the homogeneous type, from various Czech manufacturers. However, this ran into two issues. Firstly, if there were any issues with this armour, then getting it returned for quality control purposes or remakes and so forth was obviously far more complex than if it was local. But secondly, even if the quality was high, and most of the Czech armour in this particular case was actually pretty good, that relies on the Czech armour manufacturers being both willing and able to continue to sell you armour. And bringing the stuff in from overseas is already going to cost you a little bit more anyway. And of course, in the Czech Republic's case, or Czechoslovakia as it was at the time, this little thing called the German invasion meant that even if they wanted to, there was no way for the Czechs to continue to supply armour to Britain during the Second World War. That's a risk that you run. Or, if we want to wind back a little bit further, the British importing fuses for their shells at the turn of the 19th or the 20th century from the Germans. This is perfectly fine, right up until the Germans stop selling them to you. And that brings us on to our penultimate point, which I have loosely termed unique technological items. So this is a little bit of a closer focus on specific issues rather than just your overall industrial capacity to mass manufacture things, because there are certain technologies that either at the time or more generally might be fairly unique to warship construction. For example, large-scale rangefinder systems and the fire control computers to turn that data into gunfire solutions. Or, in a relatively transient period, steam turbines in the 1900 to 1910 period. These items may, at least initially at their conception and early release, be entirely foreign, and thus buying them in may entail several risks. Someone may not want to sell them to you at all, or they may be selling you sort of the generation before the ones that they're selling to their home nation, or they may be willing to sell you their latest and greatest technology, but they may want to charge you a vast amount of money to do so. This is one of the reasons, for example, why the Nassau-class dreadnoughts did not have steam turbines, because at the time, the Kaiserliche Marine looked into buying Parsons turbines, or at least a license to build them, and Parsons went, yes, this is fine, we will very happily sell you this, but we want a million marks every time you build one or buy one as an additional commission. And that was such a ridiculous amount of money that they decided they'd rather get along with vertical triple expansion engines until German turbine construction companies could come up with the goods, which caused something of a delay in the introduction of the steam turbine to the German battle fleet. So once again, you're left with a problem of, do you have the thing? If you don't have the thing, can you manufacture something that's similar to it? And if you can't do that, can you source it from overseas? And if you can source it from overseas, is it affordable? And is your overseas supplier going to be able to continue to supply you with these things? Again, by way of example, if you look at Britain during World War II, Britain would dearly have loved to purchase more 5-inch 38 guns for the conversion of some of its older ships into anti-aircraft cruisers, and they really wanted to purchase a good number of Mark 37 anti-aircraft fire control systems in order to equip not just the anti-air cruisers, but a variety of other ships. Because while Britain did have the 4-inch and the 4.5-inch and the 5.25-inch, and they did have the high-angle control system, the simple fact of the matter was that they recognised that the 5-inch was a very, very good gun. The only thing that they had that was close to matching it was the 4.5, and they weren't manufacturing huge numbers of the 4.5 at the time. And when it came to a contest between HAX 4 and the Mark 37, well, HAX 4 is much derided and perhaps a little too derided in some circles, but it certainly wasn't anywhere near as good as the Mark 37 and its associated systems in the US. So, great, we can buy from the Americans because, well, we're allied with them. Well, except for the fact the Americans are also building vast numbers of ships, and of course they want to have 5-inch 38 guns and Mark 37s on their ships, and they're going to prioritize their ships. So, no matter how much Britain might ask for them, and no matter how much they might pay for them, they're at the back of the queue. And this is a bit of a problem when it comes to the cutting edge of unique technology. Unless you've got something equally needed by the other side, which will cause them to shake loose a few systems that you need, assuming that they can manufacture them at the scale to supply two entire nations worth of demand, you may be waiting a while. And finally, you have supplies and logistics. And I'm not talking about supporting the ships once they're actually built, commissioned, and out there in the field. I'm talking about the supplies and logistics just to get the materials to the places where you're building or perhaps later refitting your fleets and getting them in the quantities needed. Because it's all very well if you've got, let's say, one specialist train that can transport large naval boilers. If you're building a dozen ships, even if that train runs 24/7, it may not be able to bring all the components in as fast as you need. So at that point, you need to build either more trains or closer factories or double the track or possibly a combination of these kinds of things. And this was a problem the Japanese faced with the Yamato class. Yes, their gun manufacturers could build the 18.1-inch gun. They tried to build bigger, it didn't work, but they settled on the 18.1. But where the gun factory was and where they were building Yamato Musashi were two very different places. And they did not have the road or rail infrastructure capable of transporting these weapons. Nor did they have the shipping capable of transporting these things. And so they were forced to add a pair of ships to their inventory that were specifically designed to be able to transport the massive 18.1-inch guns from where they'd been built to where they were needed to be put on the ships. Now, of course, for the Japanese, the Yamatos were a prestige centerpiece. They were willing to pay the price to do so. But similarly, if you're trying to build a navy and you have these supply and logistics issues, whether it be maneuvering guns or maneuvering a large enough quantity of supplies or whatever, you may well end up having to pay for an awful lot of infrastructure that's not even in a shipyard, simply to get the stuff that you need to the shipyard to build the ships. And if you can't do that, well, again, the amount of ships that you can build is going to be limited. So that's a quick overview at some of the larger issues surrounding what exactly stops you from being able to build either very large ships or huge numbers of ships, or both, if you want to radically expand your navy in the 1850s through to the 1950s. Thanks for listening, and see you again in another video soon.